This show is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
Hey, Jenny.
Hey, Chris. How's it going?
You see that? Everyone was waiting for Alan, that crumbling accent, to come in. Where is he?
Alan's gone. That's it. I've replaced Alan. That's it. I've taken him out. No more Alan. This is it. This is who you get now. Only joking. No, Alan's still around. He's out in the garden there somewhere. Just wandering. Wandering the fields, but...
I have him doing a bit of work in the orchard.
Yeah, yeah. He's looking in at the window at us there now. But no, he's tagged me in on this one. Because he was so proud of me in the last episode. He's like, let's give Jenny a chance there, see what she does.
Good stuff. Well, thanks to Alan. So you would have met Jenny last week on the first episode of Not Sponsored by the Luftwaffe. And this week, we're bringing you part two of that story.
On the last episode, we heard from Ben McQuilcha and his trip with his grandfather back to the beaches of Normandy, 60 years after he first set foot there with Allied forces.
And he was looking at this house, this blue window, and he was staring at it. And Dad looked at me, and I kind of said, I said, are you okay? Are you all right? Yeah, just, I said, Jerry came at me out of there. I went, all right. I said, what happened?
Yeah, that really was a defining journey for Ben.
Took a breath.
Because before that, it was all about the glories of war for him. A lot of that was in his head. And they were replaced quite sharply by the grim realities as he retraced his grandfather's steps.
Yeah, it was quite interesting with Ben, even when listening to it, because I edited the last piece, but his descriptions were so vivid and he described everything so eloquently. It was so impressive. He's a great storyteller, and his poetry alone captured everything so beautifully. And we're going to hear another piece of poetry from Ben now in this episode to set us all up.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's, to tip our cap to Ben. Mm-hmm. You know, he came up with these poems, but there's so much behind the poems, So Ben grew up, as you found out last week, knowing about his grandfather's place in World War II. But it was during the early days of COVID last year. So Ben got involved with a group called Trasna na Tír. So if you go onto YouTube and just search up Trasna na Tír, they have a YouTube channel. And it's actually incredible, their output last year. The amount of stories on it from local history, right across the country, and covering different aspects of history. And history lectures is what it was all about, all run via Zoom and streamed for free over COVID. And when Ben was listening to those lectures, he came across this one guy called Commandant Larry Scallon, who we introduced very briefly last week. And this week we're going to hear a lot more from Commandant Scallon.
No one intervened on behalf of the
So this week on the Hedge Radio podcast, we will discover how retired Commandant Larry Scallon helped Ben uncover the story of his great-granduncle James Heffernan and James's involvement in World War I at an infamous battle known as La Pilie, where almost a whole Irish regiment was wiped out.
We will hear about how all those Irish lives lost in World War I were erased from memory, and how an emerging new republic in Ireland made no space for its lost sons or their grieving families. Also, Commandant Larry Scallon has been helping families re-remember their loved ones.
Stay, have a listen.
Sitting perched, red breast ruffled, reflected in coal clay stained with blood. Waiting for silence, should the shelling ever stop? A whistle, rumbling, cannons, explosions, machine gun rattling, milling, relentless screaming, trudging, teeming with bodies through ladder rungs, brothers, sons. Silence. The robin with hop drops his head to gather moss from spring-laid nest, the horror and loss of a mother's son. The father's friend, as he smothers a brother's eyelids in the greenest of lichen, with no recognition for flag or nation, while its beak hovers above a child's eyes. Amidst the cries of farmers, lying on strangers amongst dying and dead, Moss-filled eyes staring skywards at smoke-shaded clouds overhead, 10 yards gained, 18 years lost. As the next whistle sounds, driving hundreds over the top, no matter the cost. Roaring, for reasons known only to them. A terror so deep-rooted that stemmed from running overwhelmed across lost children. Le Pilly, October 1914, Royal Irish Regiment killed one by one. A war one day old for some advancing at a German attack that was to come from the rear. Written statements making clear that most died from shots in the back of the head. My family's blood stained Le Pilly. James, farm labourer, aged 21, dead. Mortally wounded, suffered on a prisoner of war until his body was given the dignity of a burial by German hands. A second son, war lost to a broken man, when asked what to place on a gravestone he would never see, gave his life that others might live in freedom. As scroll after scroll with freedom of comment, YouTube clip of a Le Pilly veteran divides, collides against subtle statements with insults implied as he recounts spending the last moments with a boy of 17 spilling from his wounds as he began to confide about a love and desired bride as he slipped away in his arms while he cried. Flashbangs, splitting, spreading the wounded, hemorrhaging, high explosives of heavy, jagged flying fragments forcing through bodies as a thumb taps on the screen saying, "That lad's some liar, paddy cannon fodder for the British Empire. A fool." More foolish of me to read it. "920 sons of Wexford, Waterford, Tip and Kilkenny divided by county boundaries united at Le Pilly. We were alive, not living, but we made a stand. After 2 days, 320 prisoners of war, 350 wounded and 136 Irish children left to command. 173 left amongst the shell holes of scraps for rats, too many to save, and not enough left of 157 boys to warrant a grave. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep. The robin knows death. Not nationality, a gift of nature's clarity, birth and death, beak drop moss filling the disparity. He sings through the year in defence of spring won territory, first to the dawn chorus and last to the sunset, singing against the stillness of the cemetery. The robin perches at Le Pilly now, his red breast ruffled, reflected in rust-coloured roofs where regiments fell. New homes within rifle shot of the bullet-scored railway house, and ploughed field churning fragments of soil and shell. New homes where families live in the freedom won by those that dwell beneath their foundations. The robin now sings for their aspirations, celebrates the freedom of small nations, and mourns the loss of generations. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep.
Where did the Le Pilly poem come from then?
I always grew up knowing there was an involvement, military or otherwise, you know.
Yeah.
And I was aware, and when I say aware, I was vaguely, that there was possibly somebody somewhere in my family that had fought in the First World War.
Yeah.
Maybe. It was something I didn't give much thought to. And I remember sitting down and I'd finished that up. And then as it happened, I kind of jumped into this Trasna and the Tear thing where we were doing history lectures online during the first lockdown.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I finished this poem and I felt as if that served its purpose exactly as I felt lighter after it. It wasn't sitting in my head and it worked, you know. So I was like, okay. So I put that in the drawer. And then as it happened, there was a lecture on the Trasna and the Tear about memory of First World War and Irish involvement in First World War by Commandant Larry Scallon.
I didn't really tell anybody we were coming in this morning.
My name is Larry Scallon.
How are you, John?
I'm from Duncarmack, County Wexford, but I'm actually living in Kilkenny for the last 30 years.
Do they play football at all in Kilkenny?
No. No, they might have one football in the club just to get a rant, but they won't. They won't play football.
Yeah, I had one good day out there in 1996. After that, it's been a disaster.
That's his All-Ireland winner's medal from 2009.
But I'm happier to show people these losers' medals from 2010.
It's just, it's an all Wexford thing, isn't it? It's like, ah, help me.
Supposed to start again. I served in the Defence Forces for 33 years. I enlisted in 1988 as a recruit, and I went through the enlisted ranks of private corporal and sergeant. And then I was commissioned in as an officer in 2008, where I was a lieutenant, captain, and I retired as a commandant about this time last year.
So I rang Gran. I said, look, what's... And she sat down, she told me as much as she could tell me, and she said, I remember the car coming to tell the news. And as it happened, I found out later that once the news had arrived, there'd been a huge amount of time. There'd be something like 8 months.
8 months?
Like he'd have, in those times, still presumed he was still at war, but he'd been long since gone. And he was a farm labourer, so he was working for the Wandesfords. There was a family in Comer, Castle Comer, so the Wandesfords. And as was very common at the time, if you were a farm labourer on these places, you know, the head of the family said, look, this might be a good route for you. This will be a good wage earner for you. And she said that's how it came about. So she knew that James had been approached by Captain Wandesford, and he had taken him aside and said, look, I think you have what it takes to make a few pounds for yourself on this. You get to see a little bit of the world, you know, take a bit of a trip. It's better than spending your days here cleaning out horse boxes and all the rest of it. And she kind of said he was interested. You know, that's the kind of way she heard of it, that he was interested. And I said, okay, right. I said, do you have any other than his name? She said, no, I don't. So I rang Larry. I said, Larry, look, all I've got is his name, really. I said, I don't know. I don't even know where he signed up, why he signed up. So I gave him the name. And then within an hour, Larry came back to me. He said, yeah, we've got something here.
Every soldier is interesting, right? James was 20 when he enlisted in 1913, 5'11¾" tall.
Should have been mad for young fit men.
9 stone 13 pound.
Tall for an Irishman back then.
He enlisted in Kilkenny.
It wasn't a war, there was no sign of war then.
He didn't deploy on the 13th of August when the first shipment of Royal Irish Regiment soldiers went. He landed on the 10th of October 1914. And on the 19th of October 1914, in the very next action, in a small hamlet called Le Pellet, near Herlays in France, just off of Arbor Ridge, him and his regiment are decimated by a German assault.
The story kind of kept coming and coming and coming. And every time there was going to be something that might have been slightly sensitive in nature, like he'd always say, now, I don't know if you want to tell your grand this, but... And then he described the battle and where he died. And then only in the last couple of weeks, actually, he said, you know where he's buried now? And I said, yeah. He said, there's a story there.
About 170 soldiers were killed, 300 wounded, about 170 left of 1,000 men at the end of that battle. So James is wounded, taken a POW by the Germans, and he dies 2 days later. And James is buried by some German soldier who was thoughtful enough to put his name on a cross. James's body was exhumed by the British, and the only identifying mark that they could find, they were buried in numerical order, and his remains were a certain number on the cross, so they associated the number with James's remains. And he's one of only 12 soldiers from that battle who has a known grave. All the rest of them are lost in the dust of France. And their names are recorded in Le Touret Memorial, close to Herlays.
And that, like, to get that amount of detail, Larry, like, how'd you get your hands on all
right,
that detail?
Luckily, James's actual enlistment papers still exist, and I'll send you a digital copy later on that you'll have, and his pension records exist. His father was his next of kin, so his father got paid a pension for James's loss for the rest of his life.
You know, the naive Ben that was excited about going to Normandy is well gone.
He's gone, yeah.
And, you know, you've your own family. You're looking at this stuff. And how, so what kind of, what mind frame were you in approaching then trying to get your head around James's story?
I felt a real sadness around the fact that my entire family, for the most part, really knew very little, if anything, about this man who just had lain in the ground in France. He started to give me the first few pieces. The initial thing that stopped me was the account from the battle at Lapilli. So he said these men were Wexford, Waterford, Tipperary and Kilkenny, the Royal Irish Regiment, at Lapilli. And many of them that were in this battle, the war was only maybe a day or two old for them. So this whole thing came back into my head again of getting used to the feeling of war. James, being a 21-year-old man from North Kilkenny, working on a farm and being dropped off in trench warfare. And because of my granddad, it totally changed the way in which I approached this guy and the way I felt a connection almost instantaneously with him, that I felt just like, you know, A, what drove you to do this? Was it that you were just taking it on faith? Like, we look at these things now insofar as we can think, well, you must have had some info on it, like, you know, but really, what did they have to go on?
No idea.
I'm focusing on the fact that this guy laid down his life, not what side he chose. Or did he even choose? He didn't. And that was what my gran was saying, was like, you know, we didn't. We just knew not to speak about him. So he just went, he died and was gone. So all of this stuff was being fed through, and all the while I was kind of thinking, my God. And I said to Granny, I said, did you not know any of this was happening? Like, and she said, no. She said, he just didn't. He didn't talk about it. He just didn't bring it up. You know, she said, there was an awful shame around that, you know. But like, how was his dad? Like, I said, what way was? And he said, oh, he was destroyed. You know, he said he was just, because he'd lost Mark. And then his other son had gone, and same again. And he said he was just, and he couldn't, like he said, he accepted his medals and all, but they just didn't talk about it.
There was a sharp loss there, and his granny inherited that loss. Because, yeah, you know, she didn't have, she might have had a physical memory of it, but it was mostly a learned memory of her parents.
And Larry went and found copies of the, this is the, he's such an amazing individual. The piece that he gave my grandmother during that lockdown, it's indescribable. He gave her such peace of mind from a man that she knew died. But other than that, nothing. She knew nothing about how he died, why he died, where he died, what he experienced. Like, Larry was able to give me an account of the battle, give her all these things that he would have been awarded that had then long since disappeared. Stuff that he had been given was all, you know, was got like the likes of the dead man's penny that they say, you know, that big massive penny that they were given, and there was a cert that they would have been awarded, and all this stuff that was just gone.
And here's the thing, right? If you look at Irish soldiers in wills and next of kin, over 65% of them will have their mother as their next of kin, not their father, even when both parents are alive. There's a strong connection between Irish men and their mothers. There's one family in Kilkenny, Mrs. O'Shea. She loses four sons in the Great War. Three buried in Flanders and one buried in Palestine. And her other son came back, the fifth son, came back wounded. So, like, there's one family. Like, imagine the letter she got throughout the war, telling, you know, reinforcing, your son is gone, your son is gone, your son is gone, your son is gone. But you know what? At the end of the war, we'll send you four of these pennies and everything's okay.
It was different than listening to D-Day, because you were reading this account of these guys that were, it was done. There was no hope of them coming out of there. This hail of just fire, of shelling and shelling and shelling and gunfire, and they were pinned. They'd nowhere to go. When he was saying to me, he would have lay there for quite some time, quite badly wounded. And I thought, you poor bastard. And that was the thing that kind of came across to me, was that all these guys from Wexford and Kilkenny and Tip and Waterford, like these young fellas, these kids who were just left strewn on the soil until they got to a point where they could actually go out and see what they could find. And what kind of a way must have they have been after that initial attack? The whistle goes again, over the top, and I can't remember, was it, it was on some clip, there was a veteran and he was speaking of his experience on it, and he said that he had heard the whistle to go, so they ran, and he knew there was guys dropping, he knew there was guys vanishing around him, and they landed down into the next trench, and one of the guys that was with him fell down with him into the trench, and he looked at him and he was absolutely riddled. He knew he was spilling out of everywhere, and he went over to him and he just held him, and your man looked at him and he said I want to go home. And he told him about this woman that he wanted to marry. And, I love her. What am I doing here? And then he just faded away and he was gone. And then I remember, I just, like a fool, I looked down. And one of the first comments was, that lad's some liar. Paddy Cannon fodder for the British Empire. And it drove me spare. It just encapsulated everything that my grandmother had said. That you can't speak about that because you're seen as a turncoat. That this guy who went and sacrificed everything is seen as somehow less.
I think, Jenny, what you were chatting about earlier about Ben and his turn of phrase and what he said there, that somehow, like, his great granduncle was seen as less. To be seen as less, it's a devastating remark on your life.
Yeah,
really.
Definitely, considering what they were going through. Do you know, he said about a man spilling out blood, and it's like that man was considered less. I don't really understand how that's a logical interpretation of a man sacrificing his life and the freedom of his country to be considered less.
I know. And it was that thing, and Larry mentioned it, really World War One was about freedom for small nations. That was part of that call, you know, which Ireland was, you know. We are, of course, part of the Head Stuff podcast network, and we're only one show of many on their amazing network, and you can become a member. And one of the other shows that's on is Joe Rooney's podcast. Have you listened to it, Jenny?
Yes, I have. And the most recent episode that I've listened to, of course, with the sad news that Sean Locke has passed away this past week. His chat with Joe Rooney is a very, very special one.
It's absolutely good. Yeah, it's great. Joe spoke to Sean Locke some time ago, but Joe's got loads of other great interviews as well.
Hello, Joe Rooney here. Back in 2015, I recorded my first Potter Rooney. And since then, I've been chatting to people that I meet throughout my travels, here and there, all over the world, including Sean Locke, Mary Coughlin, Frank Kelly, Joanne McAnally, Owen Colgan, Shazia Mirza, Aidan Gillen and Katja Reardon, but loads of people you'd never heard of who have very interesting tales to tell, including the sadly no longer with us Boston-based comedian Barry Crimmins, who led a crusade against images of child abuse on the internet, Tracy Carroll, whose daughter Willow has the highest grade of cerebral palsy, Drogheda Homeless Aid, Christine Volset, a Norwegian singer-documentary maker who ended up hanging out with the young lads in Inner City Dublin and riding bareback on a horse through the city streets. All these very interesting tales to tell, and all you have to do is skip the first 6 minutes of me talking rubbish. That's Potteroni.
We're listening to how angry Ben was at the comments that he read at the bottom of a YouTube video about Irish soldiers being characterised as paddy cannon fodder. And I got into this discussion with Larry, and Larry just brings a very clear analysis to it, and he just lays bare all the nonsense around that kind of really petty armchair republicanism.
to unravel Irish history is impossible, because you'll always have perspectives. There's always a possibility to find an answer for your argument in Irish history, no matter what side you're from, because it's complicated. Those soldiers had fought in the wrong uniform, they had fought for the wrong cause, and they had become, unknowns to everybody, traitors to Ireland, because the uniform they wore had British Army buttons on it. Even though they went, for the most part, right, I'll have to define this, right? Yeah. When the war started, right, the guys went in 1914, they didn't answer Redmond's call. John Redmond called guys to action. He called for the support of the Irish National Volunteers to support small countries like Belgium and to fight in the British Army as Irish regiments in the Great War. And that was predominantly, over 90% of the Irish National Volunteers sided with Redmond and voted to support the Great War effort. But the guys who were in the army already, or militiamen serving a month a year, they were going to war whether Redmond said yes or no. Why? Because they were already in the British Army. So about 50,000 Irish men, when the bugle called, because that's what you do, you call the bugle, metaphorically, the bugle called or the whistle blew, and they were gone to the war. Whether Redmond said no, they were pre-war signed up soldiers. And then the guys who answered Redmond's call would have been started to be trained in 1914, but they didn't really see any action till 1916. So when we were fighting our Easter Rising, the guys who had answered Redmond's call were already in France and Flanders. And that brings you back then to, the war ended, and all of a sudden, everybody who had participated in the Great War from Ireland was seen as having been a traitor, because the 11th of November 1918, the war ended, and wasn't long, 6 weeks later, the first shots were being fired in Solo Head Beg at the start of the War of Independence.
Yeah, can you imagine somehow being 4 years at, what was the horror of World War One, and we've heard some stories there about what went on, and then you get back to Ireland, and within weeks of being back, the guns are out again, and Ireland are fighting what the opening shots of the War of Independence, and these guys are being expected to walk back out into this again.
Yeah, such an unfortunate moment in time for them, because it's like, come back from the war, now pick up your gun and go fight for your country if you're truly Irish. And, the trauma that they went through mentally, physically and emotionally, they're not willing to, take up arms again. And to that point, they became victims of circumstance, and then they became hated and they became ostracised to the point where, and Larry goes into this in our next part, and it's quite jarring what he reveals, that even the children of these veterans are being discriminated.
After post-war that became into being, after we became the 26 counties and our county councils became governed by Irish administrators, because up to that point it had been British administration in Ireland. Kevin Myers wrote a book a few years ago, and in one of his opening chapters he explains that the county councils in Wexford and Waterford and Kilkenny passed laws forbidding educational grants to the children of former British soldiers. So we know that the only way out of poverty in Ireland is education. Like, we've all learned that. And your ambition as a person is to see that your child can get a better education than you had, and that advances their chance of a prosperous life. Well, the New Ireland magnified the difficulty for the children of former British soldiers by denying them educational grants.
Yeah. And it just seems so petty, doesn't it? And so vicious.
Oh, vicious, yeah.
Why do you take such an interest in helping people with these stories, Larry?
Because there's an emotional connection. And there's a very real sense of bringing memories back for people, because they reconnect with something that their parents couldn't connect with properly. You're bringing back a century-old sense of loss that was now honoured with a memory. It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
And
do people get emotional?
Sometimes, yeah. Well, how could you not? Because you can actually reconnect now. Ben now knows more about James, really, than James's own parents probably by the time they died, because they were so busy moving on with their life and never forgetting that poor son that was lost in Flanders, but not having time or the money or anything to go and see where his last days on life alive were spent. And hopefully when all this lockdown ends, Ben will get over there, and if I can go with him, I will. Yeah. Just to walk the ground, because the people of Lepilli and Herlaes have built a fantastic memorial that was unveiled only two or three years ago, and they've really reconnected or connected with an Irishness, and that reconnection is forcing a change or causing a change where an Irishness, an Irish identity has evolved in Flanders, which up to 20 years ago was all British. In some of the audiovisual, the modern, you know, representations of the battles, when you're following the Irish regiments, you're seeing an Irish tricolour. It's not a British flag with Royal Irish written underneath it. It's an Irish tricolour going through the battlefield. So that's an acceptance. So the memory, the lost memory of the Irish participation in the Great War as British soldiers has now evolved into an Irish memory of Irishmen.
So when you, in modern times, mm-hmm. when you come home from a deployment or that,
yeah.
is there, you know, services in place to help you process that?
There is now, yeah. We have our PSS, our personnel support services, right? And if something happens overseas like that today, within 2 days you get a debrief team come out from Ireland to help you. Okay. So there's a whole de-escalation official. And every mission that we go with, we have our padre. Now, the padre is not just the priest. Like, I can nearly remember every padre I had on every mission, not because of his spiritual support, but because he was everybody's friend. Do you know? Like, the padre is a kind of a link between the boss and the morale of the battalion.
Okay, right.
You know, he's the unofficial gauge of how things are going. So the padre would be, if you wanted, not spiritually there to help you after something like that, but he would certainly be available for you to have a chat with.
And so can you then give an experience in thinking of the men that went off to the Great War or then came home and the war finished and they came back? No.
Do you know what? The only medication that those men had was alcohol. And lots of them became alcoholics and died. Because they couldn't deal with the trauma and come back. How could you go away for 4 years and live through that devastation of humanity and come back to Ireland and reconnect with a wife that you saw 4 years ago and hope to settle into normal life within 2 or 3 weeks or something? It wasn't going to happen. Some guys did, and fair play to them. But lots of the guys became the village alcoholic. Like, I have instances where soldiers were returned to Ireland, collected from the train, brought to the local lunatic asylum, and stayed there till the 1950s, never getting out until they died. Absolutely. Inniscarty, one. Kilkenny, two, at least. And all over the country. They were shell-shocked to within the point of being unable to be coherent. And they were just shoveled back into the country here. Some person got some small pension for them, but they had no quality of life left. Like, I'll show you a little exhibit here in a few minutes where guys were unable to drink tea out of a cup, so they made little cups with almost like what you see in a teapot with a spout, so they could bring it up and drink out of the spout. Because their shivers, they had incapable of holding anything. So you'll see lots of records or oral history. Your grandparents might have said, this guy would never sleep indoors. They weren't able to sleep indoors because their memories were, they had friends that were buried alive in Flanders in trenches. And they thought for the rest of their lives that sleeping with a roof over your head was an impossible concept. They just couldn't do it. So remember I told you a few minutes ago about this. So this is a cup that a soldier who had been injured or couldn't hold a cup properly, he could drink his tea out of a... Okay. It's like a cup with a half a cover on the top of it and a teapot spout.
Yes.
So you could suck your tea or drink your tea without spilling it all over yourself. Like, wow. That was the answer to helping soldiers that had been given lifelong psychological and physical injuries after the war.
You did mention about women serving as nurses. That, but was it predominantly men?
Oh, yeah. Well, it was 99.9% men in the Great War. You did have the sacrifice, like many women did sacrifice their lives as nurses. But it was a man's war that was fought. They were the men with pulling the triggers, like the women were trying to look after the... Like most of the nurses, right, would have felt that their main job was to facilitate soldiers to have a happy death, a hand to hold, a friendly voice, somebody that they could, you know. It wasn't that they were going to make all these guys who were devastating shell blast wounds better. You know, and that's, you know, and it must have affected a lot of them. And a lot of the nurses that died of diseases associated dealing with soldiers who were traumatized. You know, so they were putting their lives at risk just by treating guys who were wounded. Would you like to see where the executions happened just before
we go?
Actually, right, hop in my car here.
Absolutely.
John Murphy and John Phelan were captured in November 1921, having been part of the Republican forces in the Civil War. They had raided a house in Sheestown belonging to Lieutenant Colonel Shea, and some ammunition, arms and money had been removed for the use of the Republican forces to finance the Civil War. They were captured in Bishop's Lock in Bennisbridge, in John Murphy's parents' house. They were brought in here, actually his brother and John Phelan were brought in here. The brother was released, but the two boys were tried over Christmas 1921, found guilty and sentenced to death. And that death sentence was carried out right here on the 29th of December 1921. Why can I say right here? Yeah. Well, I can say it with some certainty because when we reclaimed this old space over 10 years ago and we checked the walls after, we found two bullets embedded in the walls here. So I can't say for certain that those bullets were fired during an execution, but why else would they be in the wall? So we've protected them with Perspex ever since, and we've created a space in here which, you know, there's nice flowers at certain times of the year. We have some lovely resident pigeons, which we're not ashamed of. As well as that, this was the prisoner's kitchen, where they would be allowed to, as I tell people, prepare their own bread and water. I don't know what was to be prepared. And I'll bring you in now and show you the cells, if you like.
Absolutely, Larry. Wow. So we're inside, this is the cells.
This is the cells.
Okay.
So this is, if you would like me to read out John Murphy's last letter.
Yeah.
It's actually very emotional, actually.
Absolutely, yeah.
Military Barracks, Kilkenny, December the 28th, 1922. Dear Mother, just a line, the last I shall ever write to you. John Phelan and myself are to be shot at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, so this will be the last time I shall write to you. Dear Mother, do not be downhearted. God is good. I am sending a brooch to you in memory of me. I am sending a cigarette case to Ned. I am sorry I did not get a chance of meeting you all. I was with Pat until this evening, Thursday. So far, he does not know what is about to happen us both. Give my love to all my friends and to Kitty, Bill, Sarah, Tessie and Ned, and also to Pat. The priest is coming in this evening and God is good. Don't worry. I am dying a soldier's death. I will draw to a finish as it's dark and I can't see what I am writing. I hope this news won't cause too much trouble. Cheer up all and keep a brave heart. You will not help me by worrying. I do not mind my end so much, but poor Phelan leaves a wife and three children. Goodbye, Mother, brothers and sisters, with best to all, your loving son, John. P.S. I'm quite satisfied to meet my God. Volunteer John Murphy, Kilkenny, No. 2 Brigade.
Imagine, Jenny, just being that calm the evening before you're about to be executed.
I don't think I have the faculties to actually comprehend what was going through that young man's mind while writing that. But actually, Chris, you were there with Larry as he's standing in those jail cells reading it out. What was it like? What was the...
I mean, when Larry brought me around into the yard and showed me the spot where the two men were executed, and you can see in the wall, the bullets are lodged in the wall behind where they stood them. And it was very unnerving. And you know what it reminded me of was The Wind That Shakes the Barley, that Ken Loach film. And there's that scene in the film where it's brother against brother. They're on either side of the divide and one is being executed. And it was one of the only films, I can think of two films, that my mom ever asked me to bring her to see. And The Wind That Shakes the Barley was one of them. And I remember when we left the cinema, she said something to me like, and to think that's what your great uncle went through. And I remember just being like, and you know, my mom wasn't someone to go in, she never talked about it anymore or anything. But like when I was standing there and when you read that letter and realize like civil, any war like is horrible and vicious. And from these two episodes, I think that like, that's, you know, that's really apparent.
Yeah, and in another world, these two people that are pointing guns at you could be in a pub sharing stories of a local GAA match, but here they are,
yeah,
you know, fighting for their lives against each other.
No one's intervened on
The Head Radio Podcast is a Cranog Media production brought to you by me, Chris Hayes.
And me, Jenny Murphy Byrne. Thanks to Ben McQuilcha and Commandant Larry Scallon.
And I have to say thanks to all the staff at the James Stevens Barracks in Kilkenny. And when you can and when the museum is open, go and visit it. It's really well worth it.
And a special thanks to Jesse Melia for his piece of music we heard throughout this episode today.
Find us at cranogmedia.ie and please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, we are, of course, part of the Headstuff Podcast Network. It is Ireland's largest podcast network. So please consider becoming a member of the Headstuff community. For only €5 a month, you will be supporting us and other shows on the network. And you'll get access to behind-the-scenes material from all the shows. So that's Headstuff Plus.
If you enjoy our podcast and wish to reach out, contact us at podcast@cranogmedia.ie.
Find us on Instagram @cranogfilms and all the other social media platforms. Jenny, thanks a million.
Thanks, Chris, for having me.
This week's episode was not sponsored by the Luftwaffe.
Alan, I was like, where's Alan? I thought you were going to say Alan as well, so I was like, you're going to say Alan's
name? No, come on, you killed him, he's buried out.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.